American Free Press Audio Edition Issue 15 and 16, April 8 and 15, 2019. The Real SPLC's SPLC President, Legal Director resign following complaints of rampant sexism, racism, by John Friend. The infamous Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, also known as Hate Incorporated, is one of the most powerful radical left-wing activist organizations in America. Today, however, it finds itself in total chaos due to events that have transpired in recent weeks. Morris Dees, the SPLC's infamous co-founder and leader for decades, was fired by the organization, and several other high-profile executives have now resigned. On March 13, the SPLC, which masquerades as a civil rights group, announced that it had fired Dees, as this newspaper recently reported. Few specific details have emerged regarding the subversive anti-America organization's decision to sack Dees. Top officials have said merely he was let go for misconduct. 10 days later, SPLC's president, Richard Cohen, who was regularly consulted by various mainstream media outlets as an expert on hate, announced he was resigning. "After more than 30 years at the Southern Poverty Law Center, I've decided to step down," Cohen announced in a statement released on March 23. Other legacy civil rights organizations have transitioned to a new generation of leaders, and I believe that we should, too. Shortly after Cohen's resignation, SPLC's longtime legal director Rhonda Brownstein also announced her resignation. In his statement, Cohen announced that Tina Chen, Michelle Obama's former chief of staff, would be stepping in to lead a review of the organization's policies and workplace environment. Chen is a lawyer based in Chicago who focuses on gender and racial equality issues as well as sexual harassment in the workplace. The move was praised by Brian Fair, the chairman of SPLC's board and a law professor at the University of Alabama School of Law. "The events of the last week have been an eye-opening reminder that the walk toward justice must sometimes start at your own front door and force you to look at your past so you can improve your future," Fair said following Dees's termination. "A key first step in that process for the SPLC is an immediate, top-to-bottom external review of our workplace culture and our past practices." Following the termination of Dees and the subsequent resignations of Cohen and Brownstein, employees at the SPLC have alleged that the organization is plagued by a systemic culture of racism and sexism within its workplace, according to an explosive report published by CNN which spoke with many employees on the condition of anonymity. According to one source, a pervasive racist culture exists at the SPLC where women and blacks are not valued. A current employee told CNN that blacks are frequently passed over for promotions. "My boss only hires white people," the employee stated to CNN. The recent resignations have resulted largely from a workplace revolt taking place inside the organization, according to current employees. Employees asked the president to step down, an unnamed SPLC employee explained to CNN. "He didn't do anything to change the culture, and he left because of it." The explosive allegations and controversy currently surrounding the increasingly discredited left-wing activist group will surely linger on in the weeks and months ahead. However, given the organization's massive multi-million-dollar endowment and seemingly unlimited resources, not only will the SPLC be able to continue promoting its radical left-wing agenda in America, but the fake news media will continue to promote the now discredited organization as the go-to expert on racism and hatred, as if it had not long inculcated a workplace environment rife with those very problems. AFP recognizes those battling for free speech. In this week's issue of American Free Press, we're featuring some exceptional organizations and individuals who have been taking a stand for free speech and thought in America today. We also are setting our sights on the leading anti-free speech groups in this country that have been actively working to censor and block free expression in the U.S., the worst offender, of course, being the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC. We are dedicating considerable editorial space to this, which we consider to be the most important issue facing Americans today. After all, without the ability to think and speak clearly, how can we be expected to solve other pressing matters facing this great nation, such as immigration, joblessness, war, crime, and poverty? To name a few of the issues plaguing society, as readers will see, our reports detail the real-life consequences that have come about as a result of radical activism on the part of groups like the SPLC. Americans' lives have been destroyed, people have lost their livelihoods, they have been demonized, and their reputations have been forever tarnished. Multiple young men are even facing lengthy prison sentences simply because groups like the SPLC didn't agree with their politics. Specifically, we're singling out courageous men like Baltimore attorney Glenn Allen, who lost his job a few years back after the SPLC smeared him in his local newspaper. Glenn has launched a major lawsuit against the SPLC and, in our opinion, has a better chance of beating these monsters than anyone else we know of. He is also aiming to hit the SPLC where it hurts the most, in its pocketbook. Then there is Thomas Gillen, who was facing many years behind bars because he and a few friends traveled across the country to Charlottesville, VA, to protest, among other things, a major university tearing down a statue. AFP's John Friend took time out to interview Gillen's father, who sets the record straight about his son and what happened during the chaotic, lawless demonstration. And don't forget to check out our front page this week, which provides more details about the evolving scandal inside the SPLC. To anyone who has followed the sordid career of Morris Dees and SPLC's leadership over the years, the reports coming out from inside the multi-million dollar nonprofit are no surprise. We've long known that the organization is run by a bunch of hypocrites who are interested in one thing, money. Now, from behind the locked and guarded doors at its Poverty Palace headquarters in Montgomery, Alabama, SPLC staffers are accusing the heads of the nonprofit of doing the very things they smear others with. All of this comes after the SPLC has spent decades lying to much of America to convince us of their sincerity. They've sleazed their way into some of the largest corporations in the world, pretending to be unbiased arbiters of hate. Instead, it turns out, the critics were right. The SPLC has been run by a coven of conmen, who treat their employees terribly while cashing in on their finely tuned practice of excessive scaremongering, as little old ladies and rich, white liberals fork over their hard-earned money to a group they believe could help keep them safe. Truth be told, their business model worked. The SPLC now sits on a war chest worth in excess of $400 million, much of which is reportedly kept in offshore accounts. Why a U.S. charity would keep the bulk of its assets in offshore accounts is unclear, but individuals in power beginning to sit up and take notice, such as Senator Tom Cotton, ARC, who is calling on the IRS to audit the group and reassess its nonprofit status. See page 14 for a photo spread of what kinds of expensive baubles Morris Dees was able to acquire in between his constant harassment of SPLC employees. The good news is, more and more Americans every day are beginning to take notice that something's not right. Fed up with being told what they can and cannot say, they are revolting. They are seeking out alternative news outlets like American Free Press, which better reflect their values, and turning away from major media outlets. They're also not sitting down and shutting up like so many did in the past when they were smeared as a racist or a hater. Please read our free speech spread this week carefully, and help support the individuals and the groups we profile in any way you can. For full disclosure, Paul Angel, who works with American Free Press and the Barnes Review, is on the board of directors of the Free Expression Foundation along with film producer Merlin Miller and Georgia attorney Randy Shepard. See pages 15-17 for more details and please donate generously. Never before in our history has free speech been under attack like it is right now. Christopher J. Petherick, executive editor, attorney filing unique lawsuit against SPLC speaks with AFP. Glenn Allen's stellar professional career nearly ruined by vindictive hate group. Glenn K. Allen, an attorney in Baltimore, Maryland, is the plaintiff in a lawsuit he filed in December 2018 in federal court in Maryland against Heidi Beerich, Mark Potok, and the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC. Recently, Allen sat down with AFP to talk about his case as well as free speech in the current political environment in the United States. AFP. Mr. Allen, could you give us a summary of your lawsuit? Allen, sure. In August 2016, Heidi Berich and the SPLC improperly orchestrated my termination as an attorney for the City of Baltimore, where I was doing competent and ethical work. The SPLC, in its remarkable arrogance, not only does not deny it did this but has boasted about it on one of its so-called hate maps, together, of course, with the most unflattering photo of me it could find. I have brought suit in federal court alleging 3 federal and 6 state law claims. My claims are based on the SPLC's actions against me but also on its conduct over decades that I contend is inconsistent with its status as a law firm and a purported 501(c)(3) nonprofit dedicated to an educational mission. So, in essence, I'm seeking to redress the harms done to me but also to vindicate basic principles of free expression and the rule of law. AFP, you mentioned free expression. Did you have an interest in that subject prior to this case? Alan, yes, for half a century I have seen our American traditions of free expression and free assembly as unique and fragile and have advocated constant vigilance to preserve them. I have tried to do my part to protect them. AFP, do you recall when you first became interested in these kinds of issues? Alan, actually, I do. When I was a young teenager growing up in western Colorado, I became friends with the son of a local judge, Judge William Ella. Judge Ella and his son were active with the Great Books reading program created by the University of Chicago and helped get me involved. That opened my eyes to the importance of free and open discussion of even controversial and unpopular ideas. And there was a specific incident that made a deep impression on me. At one point a young man who had burglarized a bookstore was coming before Ella to be sentenced. Burglarizing a bookstore is a bad act, for sure, but to the man's credit the books he stole were mostly books of philosophy and history. I was invited to the sentencing. Ella said to the young man, "It is within my power to send you to prison for a year or more, but I'm going to give you a break. I'm putting you on probation for 3 years, but on condition that you read those books you stole, at least most of them, and report on them to your probation officer." So the guy had to spend the next few years reading these books of philosophy and history and trying to understand them. AFP, what was the effect? Alan, he never got in trouble with the law again. AFP, maybe more judges should try that approach. Alan, you are probably right. Judge Ella was a great judge. AFP, was it experiences like that that led you to law school? Alan, yes, but it took a while. After graduating from a liberal arts college as a philosophy major, after a few years' delay I joined the Army as an enlisted man. I learned a lot in the Army that I didn't learn at a liberal arts college, believe me, and not all of it was enjoyable, but the Army did carry through on its promise to station me in Germany, where I lived for about a year off post with a German family. I learned a little about World War II from the Germans' point of view. That experience confirmed me in my views of the importance of traditions of free speech that allow even highly unpopular perspectives to be expressed. AFP, and from the Army into law school. Alan, yes. AFP, did you focus on the First Amendment in law school? Alan, well, one takes a range of classes in law school, but yes, the First Amendment was the topic I loved best. In particular, I became fascinated by the role of two famed Supreme Court justices, Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis, in the development of our country's First Amendment doctrines. AFP, Justice Holmes, the Civil War hero and Yankee from Olympus? Alan, that man. Few people realize that until the dissents of Holmes and Brandeis 100 years ago in several cases relating to criminal sentences for persons protesting America's entry into World War I, the First Amendment was basically a dead letter, toothless and rarely invoked. Holmes breathed life into it with his metaphor of the marketplace of ideas and his contention that the First Amendment protects, above all, the views we hate. He and Brandeis set our courts on a free speech path unlike any other in the world. AFP, in what respects is the First Amendment so unique? Alan, many. For one, in every other tradition with which I am familiar, in Canada, for example, it is permissible to criminalize or restrict speech based on the offensiveness of the speech, that is, the hurt feelings of the audience, and principles of good order, that is, how disruptive the speech may be. But under our leading Supreme Court cases, the offended and hostile reactions of an audience to speech are not reasons to limit the speech but the exact opposite, reasons it must be protected, and I would say American cases go beyond the traditions of other nations in protecting against vague laws that keep people guessing and therefore chill their willingness to express themselves. AFP, what is your assessment of the state of free expression and free assembly in the U.S. today? Alan, ominous. The threats arise not so much from the courts, although there are some troubling developments there, but from massive surveillance and censorship organizations such as the SPLC and from deplatforming by social media and payment processing giants such as Twitter, Facebook, and PayPal, which are not, so they contend, subject to First Amendment principles. Worse yet, these two sources of speech suppression are working together. The result is a complete abandonment of the principles that Holmes and Brandeis helped establish. These groups will accept a marketplace of ideas only if they control the marketplace, and chilling free expression is exactly what the SPLC aims to do. It creates a climate of fear by shaming people in public and harming them in their vocations as a warning to others not to step beyond the SPLC's approved boundaries. AFP, what is to be done? Alan, there is no denying we are in a perilous environment for free speech and assembly. Unfortunately, it is likely to get worse before it gets better. One critical step must be to state loudly and clearly that we are opposed to violence and intimidation as means to resolve our differences. If we do, I think in time the tide will turn, because the enemies of free expression can't keep themselves from ever more onerous restrictions on unapproved viewpoints. We must remain defiant, speaking our mind forthrightly, providing moral and financial support to others across the political spectrum who suffer for speaking their minds forthrightly, and calling out those who would enforce their narrow orthodoxies. AFP, has your lawsuit against the SPLC received much publicity? Alan, virtually none from the mainstream media, which is quite a contrast to the dozen calls I received from mainstream reporters when the SPLC orchestrated a media frenzy against me in August 2016. They were on me like piranhas. There were even reporters outside my house with television cameras. But now, when I've fought back with a lawsuit, only a few non-mainstream media, such as AFP and PJ Media, have taken an interest, and God bless you for doing so. AFP, how can our readers help you? Alan, my legal expenses are significant. The SPLC, with its bulging bank accounts of over $450 million, does not need to worry about legal expenses, but I do. Please consider a donation to www.breathing-space-for-dissent.com, which is my website. Your readers should first consider giving financial support to 501c3 nonprofits such as the Free Expression Foundation Incorporated, P.O. Box 1479, Upper Marlboro, MD 20772, which helps causes such as mine. Here are the kinds of people who need FIFS help. 1. Peter Gadiel's son was killed in the 9/11 attacks. He formed a nonprofit called 911 Families for a Secure America to advocate for secure borders and enforcement of immigration laws. All initial members of the organization were relatives of 9/11 victims. The nonprofit had many Black and Hispanic members. Gadiel himself is the son of an immigrant. Nonetheless, the SPLC labeled it a hate group and badly damaged its fundraising efforts to under the leadership of Darla Myers, a group of engaged, patriotic citizens in the street. Croy Valley in Minnesota formed a group, Citizens for the Street, Croy Valley, to advocate against Sharia law. Myers has described her group as mostly grandmas and grandpas. The group was placed on the SPLC hate map in December 2017 for being anti-Muslim, which it denies is accurate. This infamous designation seems to have been prompted by an anonymous tipster. Despite the group's vigorous protests, the SPLC has refused to change the label. The group has discovered that its local and state representatives will not address its concerns because of the hate label. 3. The SPLC included the Ruth Institute, a conservative Catholic organization, On the list of hate groups on the SPLC's 2017 hate map published across the United States and sent to organizations such as GuideStar USA and Amazon Smile Foundation Incorporated, although the Ruth Institute has made statements critical of homosexuality, it is a Christian organization for which hatred is antithetical to its Christian values. Jennifer Roback Morse, president of the Institute, has made clear that it has never practiced, threatened or condoned violence or intimidation against other groups. "We don't incite anybody to violence. We don't say we hate anybody. We don't demean anybody," said Ms. Morse. "We disagree with certain policy positions that are being aggressively promoted by professional gay rights organizations, but we disagree with their policies. That's all." For Philip Holthoff, a high school teacher in Arkansas, lost his job after the SPLC discovered he had made posts under an assumed name on a right-wing website. Even though he made the posts on his own time and did not advocate violence, the SPLC orchestrated a media frenzy and contacted the principal and supervisor of Holthoff's school. Even though the school district's ethics board cleared him of any wrongdoing, Holthoff, who has a double master's degree in history and educational administration and taught advanced placement classes at the high school, was fired and has been unable to find new work as a teacher because of the unfair publicity. Father seeks justice for activists on man who went to Virginia to protest monument tear down faces years in jail. By John Friend last October. Four young men associated with the Rise Above movement, RAM, a physical fitness and self-improvement club affiliated with the broader alt-right movement, were arrested in California and eventually flown to Virginia to face federal conspiracy to riot charges as a result of their participation in the Unite the Right rally in August 2017. The four men, Benjamin Drake Daly, 25, Thomas Walter Gillen, 24, Michael Paul Mizilis, 29, and Cole Evan White, 24, are all native Californians who had been active with the RAM organization and had participated in various political rallies both in California and Virginia. Thomas T. Cullen, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Virginia, announced the charges in early October 2018, yet all four men are still awaiting adjudication. The men stand accused by federal prosecutors of traveling to Charlottesville for the August 2017 United the Right rally with the intent to encourage, promote, incite, participate in, and commit violent acts in furtherance of a riot, an incredibly dubious charge that is largely based on malicious journalism emanating from left-wing news outlets and activist organizations, including ProPublica and the Southern Poverty Law Center, as well as radical Antifa activist groups. This case should serve as another example of the Department of Justice's commitment to protecting the life, liberty, and civil rights of all our citizens, Cullen stated in a press release when announcing the highly questionable charges. "Any individual who has their plans to travel to this district with the intent to engage in acts of violence will be prosecuted and held accountable for those actions. All four men accused are facing at least 5 years in federal prison if found guilty." Other members of RAM, as well as countless conservative and alt-right activists who have engaged in public demonstrations and political rallies protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution, have also been maliciously slandered by left-wing news outlets and dubiously prosecuted by authorities. Jim Gillen, the father of Thomas, recently spoke with this reporter to offer more insight into the truly outrageous federal criminal charges being pursued against his son and his fellow activists. "My son has been held in solitary confinement, without bail, in a Charlottesville jail," Gillen stated. Thomas Gillen and the other RAM members facing federal charges have since been transferred to the general prison population, but all were held in solitary confinement for a significant portion of their time in federal custody. Gillen went on to describe the charges his son is facing as well as the treatment he has received by federal authorities as unjust, unfair, un-American, and outrageous. "I am a fair and honorable man and I want you to know my son Tom is, too," said Gillen, a Southern California resident who works as a fireman. "He does not mistreat anyone. I might not agree with all his opinions, but I know the narrative that has appeared in some mainstream media that Tom and the other Charlottesville defendants plotted to intentionally hurt people is simply not true. That is not Tom, and not what the evidence shows. Gillen believes the federal charges leveled against his son and others are politically motivated. I strongly feel the charges against Tom and the others, which threaten them with felony convictions and 5 years in federal prison, are political in nature, Gillen stated. Any impartial person who looks at the evidence would think so. If these charges are not political, why have the Antifa demonstrators who openly provoked and committed violence in Charlottesville not been charged with conspiracy to riot? Gillen went on to note that Antifa activists have a history of committing and provoking violence all around the country, as demonstrated at countless conservative rallies and political events over the course of the past 4 years at least. They don't deny it, they brag about it, Gillen noted. They have specifically admitted they did so at Charlottesville. I have looked at numerous videos from Charlottesville and California, and I do not think Tom did anything wrong, Gillen continued. At most he was involved in some scuffles in which no one was seriously hurt or injured, in which the Antifa activists themselves provoked, and I am not the only one who thinks Antifa provoked these violent encounters. Timothy Heafy, a prominent Virginia attorney and the former U.S. federal attorney for Virginia, was hired by the city of Charlottesville to investigate the Unite the Right rally and the city's response, and he and his team did a thorough job, Mr. Heafy's report describes how Antifa and other counter-protesters blockaded the Unite the Right protesters, who had obtained legal permits to hold their rally, preventing them from carrying on their legal demonstration, while Charlottesville police stood idly by and allowed the inevitable confrontations to take place. Gillen was referring to the independent review of the Unite the Right rally published by Hutton and Williams LLP, the law firm where Heafy formerly worked while conducting the independent review. Heafy's report made clear that the Charlottesville police failed to keep the Unite the Right attendees and counter-protesters, which included radical, violent Antifa activists, separated during the day's events. Even worse, local authorities and law enforcement officials appeared to want the inevitable violent confrontation to take place in order to justify declaring an unlawful assembly, which is precisely what took place. We have evidence from the command center that the chief actually said, "Let them fight," Heafy stated during a press conference in December 2017 when his report was initially released. "Let them fight for a little while and it'll make it easier to declare an unlawful assembly." Since publishing his damning report, Heafy has moved on to accept a position as the top lawyer for the University of Virginia. "We have the facts from a respected source, and they show that Antifa and their hard-left allies provoked confrontations, and the Charlottesville police did nothing to stop them," Gillen concluded during his conversation with this reporter. "The hard-left gets a free pass, but my son and the other defendants face years in prison, are falsely portrayed in the media, and have been miserably treated while in federal custody, held without bail. This should not be happening in America." Readers are encouraged to support the Gillens in their efforts to free their son, who is still in federal custody in the state of Virginia. Tax-deductible donations may be sent to Free Expression Foundation, P.O. Box 1479, Upper Marlboro, Doctor of Medicine 20772, The Greatest Threat to Our Freedom of Speech Rights, Revival of 1968 Anti-Riot Act Designed to Suppress Unwanted Dissent, by the AFP legal staff for the last 50 years, except for one case, the so-called 1968 Federal Anti-Riot Act lay dormant and forgotten, but now the Justice Department has revived this constitutional monster, awakening it because of media outrage over the Charlottesville turmoil. "Its revival represents the greatest current threat to our First Amendment rights." Last October, teams of FBI agents swooped down on 8 young men for allegedly intending to incite a riot and for conspiring to riot. The men are accused of violating 18 U.S.C. Section 2101 and 18 U.S.C. Section 2102, the Federal Anti-Riot Act of 1968. The act was Congress's heavy-handed response to the anti-war, civil rights, and counterculture disturbances of the late 1960s. Particularly the riots in Washington, D.C. that followed the assassination of civil rights activist Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. A pall of smoke still hung over Washington, D.C. and troops circled the Capitol when the act was enacted on April 11. The act was specifically designed to battle social dissent and was based on the idea that sinister groups of outside agitators were riling up students and blacks. It was first used to prosecute the Chicago 8, the leaders of the protests at the 1968 Democratic Convention. The act pushes the limits of the Constitution in many ways. The operative passage reads, "Whoever travels in interstate or foreign commerce or uses any facility of interstate or foreign commerce, including, but not limited to, the mail, telegraph, telephone, radio, or television, with intent, 1, to incite a riot, 2, to organize, promote, encourage, participate in, or carry on a riot, or, 4, to aid or abet any person in inciting or participating in or carrying on a riot shall be fined under this title, or imprisoned not more than 5 years, or both." A riot is defined as any assembly of three people, one of whom makes a threat against property or people. Think of someone standing in front of a window and picking up a rock. That is a riot under the act. If you were standing next to that potential thrower of a rock, you are a participant in a riot. The act casts a wide net, prescribing communication along a chain of parties separated by many degrees. It is a felony to encourage, over the telephone or by internet, some second party to participate in an assembly where a third party makes a threat to the property of a fourth. Consider the example of Bernie, who sends a quick text, "Hey Alexandra, head down to the rally in front of the bank at 11. Tell Liz to give those bloodsuckers heck." Bernie is in clear violation of the act despite the fact that Bernie was not even at the rally. In fact, Alexandra doesn't even have to get the text nor Elizabeth hear the encouragement. The act makes Bernie's mere attempt at encouraging Liz enough for a criminal conviction. Even worse, under a separate paragraph of the act, the attempt is proof that you intended to promote a riot when you crossed state lines even though the message was sent weeks before. The act is unique in allowing such a chronological separation of intent and overt act. In the case of the so-called Charlottesville 4, the overt act was buying an airplane ticket to a legal rally. In the case of the California 4, it was renting a van with a credit card and driving on an interstate highway to a legal rally in Berkeley. In both rallies, the defendants clashed with Antifa groups, which were trying to disrupt the legal assemblies. The government is making the through-the-looking glass claim that the 8 defendants actually intended to be attacked when they bought the airplane tickets or drove on the interstate highway. The act also pushes the jurisdictional limits of the Constitution. Once upon a time, the federal government did not involve itself with local issues of brawling or public disorder. Over the years, however, Congress has used the Commerce Clause of the Constitution to expand its power and jurisdiction to control what people could take across state lines, prohibiting the transport of drugs, weapons to be used in a crime, or minors subject to a court order. The act takes the last step in this process. It is not an object or a person that is prescribed from being moved across a state line, but a thought or an intent to incite, to encourage, or to promote dissent and discontent, to rebel. Ironically, these are the very crimes that the founders of our nation and many of the authors of the First Amendment personally committed. The Anti-Riot Act debases the dignity of our government. The act is our government stoop to see if one of three people might be incited to throw a rock. If a rebel writes an unsent letter full of tears and anger, if students talk of a different future on the internet, the act questions the very thoughts of our citizens as they buy an airplane ticket or drive on an interstate highway. While concerned to prevent the type of tragedy that occurred in Charlottesville is understandable, the Anti-Riot Act is a reactionary, repressive law that subverts the principles upon which our nation was created. Because the act is reactionary and repressive, it is susceptible to misuse and selective prosecution against any politically unpopular group. While it was created to bash leftist hotheads and civil rights activists, the Justice Department has bowed to political pressure and resurrected the act to bash the alt-right. With the current prosecution, the government has averted its eyes from the clear evidence that Antifa groups attacked and disrupted the pro-Trump rallies in Huntington Beach and Berkeley and the Charlottesville alt-right assembly. Among the hundreds of rowdy people at the three political rallies, only the 8 have been charged by the government. In order to justify the current prosecutions, the Justice Department twists both facts and law. In its omnibus response to Charlottesville defendant's motion to dismiss, the Justice Department asserts, this case is not about free speech or the right to assemble for political purposes. This is a bold claim considering the Anti-Riot Act was promulgated precisely to control speech that incited, promoted, encouraged, or organized. That the government has accused these defendants of the political speech crimes of incitement, promotion, and encouragement, and that the courts have already dismissed similar governmental obfuscation. In the leading case from 1972 reviewing the Anti-Riot Act, United States v. Dellinger, Dellinger was one of the Chicago Eight. Judge Fairchild discussed the obvious connection between the Act and the First Amendment. As to the Anti-Riot Act, the government at times argues that travel with intent and not expression is the gravamen of the offense and that, therefore, the doctrines of the First Amendment are not relevant to our determination of constitutionality. We are unable to accept this argument. A realistic approach compels application of a First Amendment test to a statute which punishes activity leading up to and furthering a riot, for at least two reasons. One is that rioting, in history and by nature, almost invariably occurs as an expression of political, social, or economic reactions, if not ideas. The rioting assemblage is usually protesting the policies of a government, an employer, or some other institution, or the social fabric in general, as was probably the case in the riots of 1967 and 1968, which are the backdrop for this legislation. A second reason is that a riot may well erupt out of an originally peaceful demonstration which many participants intended to maintain as such. It is by expression, in whatever form, that causation adequate to bring on punishment must be most likely to occur. Since 1968 and the Dellinger opinion, the Supreme Court has expanded First Amendment protections for political speech. Rather than follow the law, the Justice Department pretends the Anti-Riot Act has nothing to do with the First Amendment. In fact, the current prosecution threatens to unravel 50 years of First Amendment progress. The Justice Department should step back and reconsider the dangerous effects of this case on First Amendment rights. Instead, the Justice Department has made the bureaucratic response, try to justify the prosecution by distorting facts. To read the government's response, one would get the impression that not a single Antifa-affiliated person showed up to disrupt the Unite the Right rally or that the Charlottesville police, after having promised to keep the two sides separated, ensured the confrontation. There is no indication that the highly unpopular guys from out of town are being scapegoated for the acts of others. This underscores another flaw with the act. It is not designed for the current conditions of polarization politics. The legislative history of the Anti-Riot Act manifests an intent on the part of a legislative faction to destroy what was believed to be a close-knit group of outside agitators. The idea that the riot would be caused by people incited to attack the organizers was not considered by Congress in 1968. The Justice Department is continuing this error. The government is essentially taking the position that the organizers and attendees of a legal assembly can become criminally liable if scuffles break out at the event, even if they are caused by the acts of counter-protesters. Congress spread its net too widely when drafting the Anti-Riot Act. It was always constitutionally questionable, but its defects have become manifest in the last 50 years, given recent Supreme Court rulings on protected expression. Congress did not consider that its definition of riot was too broad, that its imposition of liability was too expansive, or that its definition of intent was too amorphous and inclusive, all to the effect of denying First Amendment protections to marginal groups most in need of them. The government should put the Anti-Riot Act back to sleep. The Two Tiers of Justice, by Dave Gallery. While the Windy City has a well-deserved reputation for corruption and scandal, the latest imbroglio to roll through the city's crime-ridden streets caught even the most jaded Chicago watchers off guard. Now, even those who have given up watching TV know the name Jussie Smollett and have been plainly shown that super-rich Hollywood stars are afforded preferential justice. California-born Justin Smollett, 1982, began his career as a child actor at the age of 5, but it wasn't until 2014 that Smollett hit it big, landing a role in the series Empire portraying a gay musician. According to The Hollywood Reporter, He was earning $2.25 million a season, though there were rumors his contract was not going to be renewed. Is that the reason, people are asking, why Smollett felt it necessary to stage several fake hate crimes against himself? According to law enforcement sources, on January 22, a letter arrived addressed to Smollett at the Chicago studios where Empire is filmed, depicting a stick figure hanging from a tree with a gun pointing towards it. Scrawled on the letter, "Smollett, Jesse, you will die," and the now four-letter word MAGA, Make America Great Again, in red letters. The letter also contained white powder, prompting a response from a hazmat unit, which was later determined to be aspirin or Tylenol. The Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Postal Inspection Service are investigating whether the actor had something to do with the letter, which now appears likely. A week later, Smollett claimed he was attacked by two white thugs wearing MAGA hats, who launched into a tirade of racist and homophobic slurs, then battered Smollett about the face, topping that off by pouring bleach on him and slinging a noose around his neck. Smollett first entered a hotel with the rope still left conveniently around his neck, kept it on until police arrived to investigate, then reported to a hospital, and employed his acting skills, claiming the attack was motivated by his criticism of the Trump administration, and was linked to the aforementioned letter. The usual left-leaning cast of characters rallied around Smollett, including Democratic Sens, Kamala Harris, Califf, and Cory Booker, NJ, who both described the reported attack as a modern-day lynching. These two possible U.S. presidential candidates then used the hate crime to promote their anti-lynching bill. Initially investigated as a hate crime, the overburdened Chicago Police Department later determined the actor orchestrated the event. The two racists who attacked Smollett were two Nigerian brothers with a professional connection to Smollett, identified from surveillance video, who told law enforcement investigating the incident that Smollett was upset the letter didn't get enough attention. A few weeks after the crime, two Chicago police sources told CNN, Chicago police had discovered evidence indicating that Smollett had paid the two brothers $3,500 to stage the attack. Additionally, financial records show that the Nigerians bought the noose at a hardware store, and they were caught on security camera footage in the clothing store where they bought the ski masks, gloves, and red hat they used in the attack. The clothing store didn't carry any MAGA hats, although the brothers asked if they did, as evidence continued to mount that Smollett was the mastermind of the hate crime hoax, and he was arrested and indicted on 16 felony counts of disorderly conduct for repeatedly lying to law enforcement. The entire nation was floored when it was announced that all criminal charges had been dropped and that the case was then sealed by the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Reaction was swift and severe from many quarters, including the mayor of Chicago, who sent a letter to Smollett's attorneys for immediate payment of $130, $106.15 to resolve this matter without further legal action within 7 days. Demonstrations are continuing to erupt in Chicago over this matter, with a group led by the City Police Union demanding the resignation of the Cook County State's attorney and another group led by civil rights leader Jesse Jackson supporting the embattled prosecutor. Especially irked over this was much of America's black community, revolted by the blatant double standards in light of the high prosecution and incarceration rates for blacks committing much lesser offenses. To gain some insight into this, American Free Press spoke with U.S. Air Force veteran, Tea Party organizer, and member of Project 21's National Advisory Council, Indiana native Emery McClendon. According to its website, Project 21 is an initiative of the National Center for Public Policy Research to promote the views of African Americans whose entrepreneurial spirit, dedication to family, and commitment to individual responsibility have not traditionally been echoed by the nation's civil rights establishment. Emery commented on the preferential treatment he of the wealthy actor, instead of doing time. M.R. Smollett has been given the opportunity to work for Operation Push, which is Jesse Jackson's operation in Chicago. M.R. Smollett performed a few tasks for them and everything is going to be wiped clean. The problem that Project 21 has with it, and also after hearing some of the comments from the black community around the country in social media and so forth, is that Mr. Smollett seems to have gained a lot of privilege simply because of who he is and what he is and what he is doing in the Hollywood scene. So that shows favoritism for this celebrity, and at the same time they see other people from their communities, black people that they know, people that they deal with, that are not only being prosecuted, but incarcerated, and paying humongous fines. This is very blatant. This TR system of justice seems to be on broad and open display here, and we have spoken out against it. McClendon believes that black people should be rightfully outraged over Smollett's slap on the WRist. A lot of people in the black community are complaining because they are saying that it is unfair because that is not the way they are being treated when they go through the criminal justice system. That for any little infraction, whether it be a misdemeanor or a felony, they have to go through the complete process, hire an attorney, go into a court of law, unless there's no evidence against them. But this is not going to happen with Jussie Smollett. Of course, while dozens of black people are being murdered on the streets of Chicago every day, city police had to waste time investigating this phony hate crime, said McClendon. And you have a police department that has a problem with shootings. Chicago has one of the largest number of shootings year after year after year, and the police department had to go out and waste hours and hours of manpower on this fake hate crime, while all these shootings and murders are still going on. But you have a limited number of resources, and the police can't investigate those crimes because they have wasted all that time on the Jussie Smollett case. Can you imagine what those officers felt like who went out and pounded the streets to find witnesses and gather evidence and presents he had to the chief and prosecutors? Incredibly, Smollett was up for an NAACP Image Award for outstanding achievements and performances of people of color in the arts, announced after the hate crime hoax, something Project 21 strongly opposes. We have already spoken out on this and said that the award should be rescinded because of what Smollett has done here as far as the lying and as far as the false charges and the 16 felony counts. He was arrested for that and charged with it and is going to get away with it. What kind of a message does that send to the black community, the young people, and also to those who are already incarcerated? And many of these prisoners have really been incarcerated unfairly and didn't get a fair trial, and now here he is not going to get anything. McClendon was also irked that Smollett seemed to have gotten some help from higher up. There are also rumors of some outside interference, because of ties or because of who you know and who you're associated with. You can find yourself on the positive side of prosecution where things just automatically get dropped, and then there's no explanation for it. And people don't like this because they know they don't have the type of privilege. This is really a troubling situation here. McClendon may have been referring to the mysterious involvement of former First Lady Michelle Obama's chief of staff, Tina Chen, who appears to have successfully pressured Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox to drop the charges against Smollett and seal the case so no one can ever find out the real facts. As for whether or not the Smollett case is over and done with, McClendon isn't so sure. It's going to be interesting how this whole thing plays out in the awards ceremony, whether this will even be mentioned or brought up by the media or the NAACP. But I don't think we've heard the last of this as far as people filing complaints and so forth, asking for justice to be done. It's a very unfortunate thing, a mind-perplexing thing. The good news is that, according to multiple sources, the dismissal of the state's case has not impacted an ongoing federal probe into Smollett's fake hate crimes. Time will tell if Smollett will ever receive the impartial justice he deserves. A special appeal from the Free Expression Foundation. You can help people fighting for their free speech rights. New free speech organization seeks to counter growing power of far-left activist groups. By Charles Randy Shepard, ESQ. As an attorney for over 40 years, an avid student of history, and a proud American, I have looked with increasing alarm at the state of free expression in our nation. I know well that people, especially free people, will argue and dispute on many important questions, often passionately. This aspect of our common humanity should be embraced, not condemned. But I know also that there must be civil rules of engagement for such disputes if we are not to devolve into anarchy. I am writing this today because I believe those civil rules of engagement, those traditions, legal and cultural, developed over centuries and often at the cost of the blood of martyrs, for resolving inevitable disputes, are being relentlessly destroyed today. I propose to fight to reclaim and protect those traditions and liberties, and I need your help. You may not be greatly familiar with doxing, that is, the use of targeted persons' private and confidential information to disrupt or cause loss of employment, disrupt or destroy personal relationships, harass, or generally incite trepidation in the lives of the targets and those around them, or with deplatforming, that is, the denial of access to social media, such as Facebook or Twitter, credit card merchant services, and even email services with a view to preventing the expression of certain viewpoints. I, too, was not familiar with these pernicious practices until recently, but these practices are now increasingly widespread and indisputably effective in preventing the robust dialogue on which, in the words of Judge Learnhand, we have staked our all. They, together with the massive surveillance that accompanies them, are similar to the thought control apparatus of communist and other totalitarian regimes. They are a disgrace to our American traditions, and, I will say, are counterproductive in creating the social harmony they supposedly seek, as they breed fear, anger, distrust, and division. They are the dangerous culmination of decades of tactics for suppressing free expression. I have joined with other like-minded persons to combat this grave threat to our civil liberties. Together we have created a new nonprofit, the Free Expression Foundation, Incorporated, FEF. Last August, FEF obtained confirmation of its 501(c)(3) status from the IRS. FEF's mission is to provide legal, financial, and moral support for persons and entities that have suffered or are at risk of suffering legal, financial, and social harm as a result of the exercise, attempted exercise, or intention to exercise their rights of free expression, including the rights under the First Amendment of the Constitution and analogous rights under international, state, and local charters and laws. Donations to it will be tax deductible. Our dream is that FEF will be there for victims of vicious, out-of-control doxing, deplatforming, and other attacks on the exercise of the rights to free expression. With your help, the FEF will conduct legal analysis. We will closely examine the facts and the law and determine if the victim has grounds for legal redress, provide or obtain legal counsel. If our legal analysis determines that the victim has a legal claim, we will get to work to obtain legal counsel for him or her, help with urgent expenses. Suddenly losing your job from a smear campaign by the Stalinist Grand Inquisitors can create immense financial stress. We would like FEF to be in a position to provide at least some financial aid to these victims, provide moral support. People who find themselves defamed, ostracized, and publicly shamed invariably feel isolated and highly vulnerable. We want the FEF to be able to provide moral support for all such victims. My friends, the FEF needs your most generous support. You can help us by informing us of victims of un-American, Stalinist thought control. All too often they suffer in isolation and silence, and that must not happen. You can help us with a monetary gift. It takes money to operate an effective organization with the ambitious goals we are setting for the FEF. The Southern Poverty Law Center, with its present net worth of $450 million, growing every year, has been enormously successful in fundraising. Many critics see it as essentially a fundraising operation masquerading as a civil rights organization. If the FEF could raise a small fraction of the SPLC's war chest, it could punch above its weight and have a real impact in preserving those inestimable privileges, as Patrick Henry called them, a free expression and honest debate. Indeed, we have a moral duty to preserve these for future generations, as our ancestors preserved them for us. In the cause of liberty, I thank you, H. Charles R. Randy, Shepherd, ESQ, Free Expression Foundation board member, lives in Augusta, GA, except for a few years in private practice. M.R. Shepherd spent most of his professional career working for the state of Georgia as an assistant prosecutor in the office of the district attorney of the Augusta, GA, judicial circuit. He was the appellate law specialist in that office and filed hundreds of briefs on behalf of the state in the appellate courts of Georgia. At the end of September 2012, M.R. Shepherd retired as an assistant district attorney after almost 30 years of government service. He is presently practicing law on a limited basis. An urgent appeal from Glenn Allen. I think we have a real chance to defeat the SPLC in court. By Glenn Allen and you. You need to stop asking so many questions, snarled my 10th grade teacher in the Colorado town where I was then living. He was tall, thin, bespectacled, vexed, and pointing his bony index finger at me. He was clearly having a bad day, and so he stomped around the classroom berating the students, definitely including me, that he found particularly troublesome. But he wasn't the first, or the last, to complain that I asked too many questions, and he was right. In a way, I do ask too many questions. For some people, the Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, I'm writing you, a potential supporter of the New Free Expression Foundation, Incorporated 501(c)(3) nonprofit, because I have reason to believe you too have an inquiring mind even on controversial, sacred, cow topics, and that you respect others who make similar probes, even if you may not agree with their views. Your help urgently needed. Let me speak plainly. There are overlapping networks of power in America today, run by savvy, active, unprincipled, ruthless people, that give lip service to our robust First Amendment traditions but whose real aim is to prevent honest debate on controversial topics such as race, diversity, immigration, cultural Bolshevism and many others. Their modus operandi is to destroy those who dissent from the views they approve, and they are highly skilled in crushing anyone who steps outside the narrow lines they draw. I know, I'm one of their victims, one of their many victims. My name is Glenn Allen, CAFP's interview with Glenn on page 4-5 of this issue, ed. After graduating from college with a degree in philosophy, I served honorably in the U.S. Army and then attended law school, from which I graduated near the top of my class. For the next 27 years I practiced complex litigation for a large law firm, working on cases that sometimes reached all the way to the United States Supreme Court. I worked ethically and diligently and earned an excellent reputation. I devoted many hours to pro bono work helping people who needed help whether they were black, white, Muslim, Jewish or any other. It simply didn't matter to me what race or religion you were. After retiring from the law firm, I went to work for the city of Baltimore, where I threw my heart into helping solve Baltimore's often daunting legal challenges. I felt a quiet but justifiable pride in what I, raised in a broken and often poor family, had accomplished, and looked forward optimistically to the future. Support this suit against the SPLC and the efforts of the Free Expression Foundation. Yes, I want to support Attorney Glenn Allen's lawsuit against the SPLC. This suit is unique in that Glenn is going after the SPLC for abusing its status as a 501(c)(3) nonprofit organization and for violating the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. In this case, the SPLC used admittedly stolen documents from a controversial organization to smear donors and improperly used its power and resources to try to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president. The SPLC is trying to impose Soviet-style thought control on America. Let's fight back. Note: those who donate $100 or more will receive a free copy of Glenn's 80-page brief. Free Expression Foundation Incorporated, P.O. Box 1479, Upper Marlboro, Doctor of Medicine 20772. Note: American Free Press endorses the efforts of FEF. Note: your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent of the law, targeted by more SDs in the SPLC. All this changed abruptly and profoundly on August 17, 2016, when the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, published a distorted hatch article about me and made it a news story in dozens of newspapers around the country. Within 2 days I lost my job, my reputation was destroyed, and I became a pariah in the city and legal community I had served honorably. The fact that I had worked zealously and ethically in my law practice and for the city of Baltimore was of no interest to the SPLC. Why would the SPLC care about such things? Its goal was to destroy a political nonconformist as a warning to others and to make money for itself, just like the old Soviet Union as it happened. About the time the SPLC attacked me, I had been reading a book that contained a Russian immigrant's account of her life under the old Soviet regime. As I read that account again as the SPLC nightmare was unfolding, I winced. Here is her account. I look at the people who support the transformation of America in disbelief. They are destroying the very land that gave them so much opportunity. In the USSR, representatives of the Communist Party were ingrained into every aspect of civilian, official, and military life. These political organizers controlled public order by observing the behavior and speech of every citizen. People who wanted a more secure and privileged life found it necessary to join the propaganda machine. In order to survive, citizens were silent out of fear of retaliation by the authorities. I winced because I felt I was reading a description of what life was fast becoming here in America under the growing domination of Soviet-style thought control networks such as the SPLC, the liberal media, the entertainment industry, our schools and campuses, and our government. I shook my head in disbelief. Could this really be happening in America? WH, what can we do about IT? Let's get real. It is happening with ever-growing intensity. The critical question is, what shall we do about it? To borrow words from Patrick Henry's famous Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech, shall we lie supinely on our backs until our enemies have bound us hand and foot? Or, if we wish to be free, if we mean to reserve those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have so long been engaged, we must fight. I say we fight back. With your support, the Free Expression Foundation, Incorporated can be an effective means for doing so. Please let FEF hear from you. Let's not lie supinely on our backs but stand tall on our feet, and fight. Please give your most generous donation today. Free Expression Foundation condemns violence as a solution. All Americans deserve the right to free speech, whether they are on the left or on the right. By Paul Angel, it has become a disheartening image seen all too frequently. A deranged radical, hoping to make a political point, sucker punches a perceived adversary in the face. It's been a refrain sung by the left for several years, whereby individuals are encouraged to punch a Nazi. The problem is, in today's strange world, anyone who is not on the far left of the political spectrum is, to the neo-Bolsheviks out there, a Nazi. From the grandma working against illegal immigration to the newscaster who has the guts to point out the hypocritical posturing of Antifa, alt-right figure Richard Spencer was a victim of a sucker punch, and the leftist perpetrator was never apprehended or charged. More recently, critic of radical Islamist Majid Narwaz in England received the same barbaric treatment, and still more recently, on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley, one Zachary Greenberg viciously attacked a conservative activist in the face because the activist was protesting fake hate crimes. Many more instances, unfortunately, could be cited. The Free Expression Foundation, FEF, condemns this political violence. But, a devil's advocate may ask, why? Isn't a good punch in the face a dramatic way to make a political point and intimidate your adversaries? It may be dramatic and intimidating, but it is still reprehensible. There are several reasons why such actions must be denounced. First, Western civilization, at its best, is grounded on respect for the autonomy of the individual, and this means giving the individual space to speak and advocate effectively. Enforced silence by violence violates this principle of free speech and thought. Second, political violence leads to counter-violence and a debasement of the rule of law. Individual liberties cannot flourish in an environment of thuggery and chaos. Third, when some voices are silenced by physical attacks, the likelihood of truth being discovered and made public is greatly lessened. Fourth, democracy is in a constant dynamic between stability and change. The proper balance, the proper gradual adjustments, cannot be achieved if free expression is threatened. To slightly reword a famous maxim by Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, the remedy for speech that offends is not enforced silence, whether by law, deplatforming or a sucker punch in the face. It is more and freer speech. That is the remedy Free Expression Foundation advocates. Leave the violence to the thugs. America was founded with a respect for the opinions of others. But rest assured, If we are confronted violently, we must all defend ourselves and our families. Media censorship campaign. White specifically targeted any form of speech demonstrating white pride banned. By John Friend. Facebook and Instagram, arguably the most influential and popular social media sites in the world, announced recently that they will begin to ban any form of praise, support, and representation of white nationalism and white separatism on their platforms, according to an official statement published by Facebook. It's clear that these concepts are deeply linked to organized hate groups and have no place on our services, Facebook stated in its announcement, which has drawn both praise and condemnation alike from social media users, civil rights groups, free speech activists, and others. Facebook, which owns Instagram, has long prohibited content on its platform that targets individuals based on race, ethnicity, or religion, with users regularly being suspended or banned by the social media giant for expressing so-called hateful or racist perspectives. Even many conservatives and alternative media personalities, such as Alex Jones, have been either banned or suspended from Facebook. Facebook and Instagram's newly announced ban on white nationalism and separatism is perhaps the most Orwellian censorship policy conceptualized yet. Facebook now will not tolerate praise or support for white nationalism and white separatism, while also claiming to allow its users to be able to demonstrate pride in their ethnic heritage. Critics of the newly announced policy wonder how white people will be able to demonstrate pride in their ethnic heritage on the platform without being considered a white nationalist or separatist, and thus banned from the platforms. This is just part of the very wide-ranging campaign to expunge the ideas of the dissident right, a campaign that includes book banning by Amazon, Twitter banning and shadow banning, and financial companies like PayPal refusing service to basically anyone denounced by groups like the Anti-Defamation League and Southern Poverty Law Center. Dr. Kevin MacDonald, a former university professor and author, told this reporter, "A policy that only whites are banned for racial pride is outrageous and clearly involves double standards. Obviously, they are afraid of our ideas." Faith Goldie, a Canadian activist and independent journalist who recently ran for mayor in Toronto, was equally as critical of the newly announced policy. Facebook's decision to censor so-called white nationalism, which really amounts to any post discussing demographics, is the latest big tech flailing in the general direction of free speech, Goldie explained to this reporter. "The next generation will have no concept of the internet's original form as the marketplace of ideas. Rather, they will only be exposed to the filternet. The filternet will bring about two outcomes, groupthink and ghettoization. Rather than bringing dissenters closer to the elite's globalist worldview, it will only push these individuals further to the fringe, where they will fester," Goldie concluded with a rather ominous warning to those promoting censorship and deplatforming of conservative and alternative voices. "If people are banned from expression and debate online, they will take their gripe to the streets and it will take a lot more than an algorithm to stop them," Goldie stated. Many so-called civil rights groups, including the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, and Color of Change, praised the new policy, which they argue will help combat racial violence and supremacy. "It's no longer enough for companies to only respond reactively to tragedies with long overdue policy changes like this one," Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, said in a statement following Facebook's announcement, referring to the new policy. "Join us in calling on all Texians to take aggressive action to prevent the spread of extremism online." The Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center both work closely with large tech companies and social media giants, including Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, in order to combat what they define as hate and bigotry, which essentially amounts to any criticism of multiculturalism, massive immigration to America and the wider Western world, and other policies pushed and advanced by the forces of globalism and the New World Order. PC police see their own far left now going after those feminists who won't toe the line on identity politics. By Tilton Adler. Most Americans probably have never heard of the label trans-exclusionary radical feminist, TERF, before. Censorship, on the other hand, is a phenomenon most people are familiar with. as it has become a major issue, especially in the world of alternative news. The connection between these two, though, may surprise you. TERF is actually a derogatory term that's used to label certain feminists, who have the audacity to believe that biology determines gender and that the narrative constructed by far-left activists and the liberal media, that self-professed identity defines gender. In other words, if a man wants to be a woman, he can just decide to be one, is not only incorrect but dangerous, especially for young people. The irony here is that the radical feminists that fall into the so-called TERF category are generally considered to be left-leaning. Now some of these women are being censored online simply because they publicly state that, in fact, men cannot be women even if they run hormones and undergo radical surgeries. Clearly, censorship on the internet is no longer picking political or ideological sides. For example, Megan Murphy, a left-leaning feminist blogger and activist who founded the blog Feminist Current and has been outspoken within the Women's Liberation Front, WLF, was permanently banned and her account removed from Twitter after she intentionally misgendered and deadnamed a transgender person. Her crimes consisted of referring to a transgender person by their biological pronoun rather than their assumed pronoun. Deadnaming is when someone uses the trans individual's previous name, such as calling them Sam instead of Sally. Social media behemoth Twitter says these actions violate its hateful conduct policy and has banned individuals for the crime of calling a biologically male trans woman a he instead of a she. In 2018, the free website service WordPress abruptly shut down numerous feminist blogs. WLF and several other well-established groups had over 8 years of posts removed without warning and were told, only after the fact, that their content had been removed. Attorneys at WLF wrote, "No evidence has been provided that so much as a single post on any of these feminist sites contained any incitement to violence or other criminal activity, or in any way constituted speech not protected under First Amendment rights." Evidently, their voices were censored simply because they don't adhere to mainstream media's attempt to make us accept politically correct transgender policy, regardless of its inherent harm to women and girls. And it's getting worse. Like it or not, Americans are now living in an era in which saying there are only two genders is not only politically incorrect but in states like New York and California, as well as in Canada and the UK, it is now a punishable crime. Bolstered by existing discrimination laws, the New York City Commission on Human Rights has stated that employers, landlords, and providers of services can be fined anywhere from $125,000 to $250,000 for calling transgender individuals by the wrong name, gender, or pronoun. Given the now lucrative result of complaining that one's rights have been violated, what is to stop an average Joe from suing if one day he decides he's now an average Josephine? For those who claim these debates don't affect anyone living in the real world, in the UK, there was a recent case where a 52-year-old biological man, who identified as a woman, was sent to a women's prison after he was convicted of, among other things, sexually assaulting women and children. Then, as an inmate, he proceeded to rape more women. According to the UK Centre for Crime and Justice Studies, a male-bodied prisoner who had a gender recognition certificate as female had to be transferred to the female estate even though one of her index offences was attempted rape of a woman. This is exactly the type of scenario these censored liberal feminists are working to prevent, and, for that, they face derision and censorship among others on the left. The terrible 10. Here are some of the entities that are deciding what you are allowed to see, say, read or think. The Anti-Defamation League, ADL, one of the most vicious and effective tools used against the freedoms enshrined in the Constitution's Bill of Rights. The Anti-Defamation League, ADL, is the international organization ostensibly dedicated to snuffing out anti-Semitism and all forms of bigotry, founded in 1913 to exonerate Leo Frank, the Jewish-American factory boss convicted of murdering a 13-year-old female employee. The ADL has been on a tear to prevent any and all criticism of Israel, using their control over politicians across the globe and via the courts. In the U.S., the ADL is one of the main organs seeking to remove any mention of God and Christianity. including manger scenes and Christmas trees, from the public square, capitalizing on the Supreme Court's errant use of the created out of thin air doctrine of separation of church and state, currently headed by Jonathan Greenblatt. Amazon too launched as an online bookstore in 1994 by Jeff Bezos. Amazon is now a multinational corporation focusing on e-commerce, cloud computing, and artificial intelligence, and is the largest e-commerce marketplace and cloud computing platform in the world. In July 2018, Bezos was named the richest man in modern history, after his net worth increased to $150 billion. Amazon went on a book-burning binge in 2017 after thousands of threats were called into Jewish community centers around the world, only to be discovered later the culprit was an Israeli-American. Bezos didn't offer to restore the hundreds of titles, mostly revisionist history books, his company banished after this revelation. Amazon continues to delist titles that challenge the status quo. Facebook 3 began in 2003 by Mark Zuckerberg as a website called Fasimash, which asked users to compare two pictures of people and pick the better-looking one. Facebook evolved into an online social media and social networking service giant with over 2 billion monthly active users. Facebook regularly assigns users to Facebook jail, a 30-day ban from using the service, when their rules are violated. Although they never really explain exactly why the user was banished, certain websites are permanently blocked from having their websites' links placed on Facebook, like VeteransToday.com, most likely due to the regular criticism of Israel's apartheid policies. Facebook acquired Instagram, the photo and video sharing social networking service, in 2012, and applies its censorship tactics to that site as well. George Soros. For George Soros, born the Schwarz Gyurgy in 1930 in Budapest, is arguably the face of social discord and unfettered immigration into previously Anglo-Saxon-dominated Western societies. An investor and philanthropist, tagged the man who broke the Bank of England after he bet against the UK's currency and turned a profit of over $1 billion, and Soros's net worth was over $8 billion last year. But he has donated over $32 billion to his Open Society foundations, named no doubt for his view on how all countries should be organized, completely dedicated to leftist causes. Soros stated in an interview with the Washington Post that removing President George W. Bush from office was the central focus of my life and a matter of life and death, stating that he would sacrifice his entire fortune to defeat Bush if someone guaranteed it. He has been tied to the funding of the relatively new disruptive entities Black Lives Matter and Antifa, both dedicated to upending U.S. civilization rooted in the rule of law. Google 5. Google, listed as the most valuable brand in the world as of 2017, owns Google.com, the most visited website in the world. Founded in 1998 by Larry Page and Sergey Brin while PhD students at Stanford University, some of Google's other divisions claim the top 100 most visited websites in the world, including YouTube, the ubiquitous video sharing website that never met a video questioning the powers that be that it didn't delete. Google is roundly criticized for paying little mind to its users' privacy concerns, its pattern of tax avoidance, glaring antitrust issues, censorship, and Google Search's search neutrality. Google has come under fire lately for its leftist agenda, leaked to the press via videos and emails. Media Matters for America 6, founded in 2004 by former conservative journalist turned progressive David Brock, to combat the conservative journalism sector that he had once been a part of. The nonprofit Media Matters for America, MMFA, spends its time and money monitoring and comparing U.S. news sources to reach absurd conclusions like Democrats and progressives are outnumbered by Republicans and conservatives in terms of guest appearances on television news programs. Funded by the usual leftists, MMFA's policy is not to list their donors, although it was revealed that in 2010, everyone's favorite progressive, George Soros, concerned over recent evidence suggesting that the incendiary rhetoric of Fox News hosts may incite violence, donated $1 million. MMFA's latest favorite target is conservative political commentator Tucker Carlson, who appeared on CNN and MSNBC before landing on Fox News in 2009. Carlson was not a target when he was on left-leaning fake news networks. PayPal 7 launched in 1999. PayPal operates a global online payments system, accommodating online money transfers, acting as an electronic alternative to paper checks and money orders, serving over 250 million users and annual revenue in 2017 of over $13 billion. Acquired by online auction site eBay in 2002, the company is regularly embroiled in controversy and litigation. Its most recent space in the headlines brought about by its 2018 banning of alternative journalist Alex Jones and his website InfoWars for content that was hateful and discriminatory against certain religious groups. PayPal freezes the accounts of users who don't subscribe to its worldview, which generally means criticizing the powers that be too forcefully, shutting down the user's livelihood. On top of the freezing, they even brazenly hold money in the account. A typical email from PayPal informing a user that they've fallen out of favor with the financial behemoth states, "After reviewing your account activity, we've determined that you're in violation of PayPal's acceptable use policy. As a result, we've placed a permanent limitation on your account." As per the user agreement, when PayPal places a permanent limitation on an account, any funds in your account will be held for 180 days. Southern Poverty Law Center 8. The greatly disgraced Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, was founded in 1971 as a nonprofit legal advocacy organization. Its original targets were white supremacists, but after those were all capitalized upon and run out of town, there were only a handful. The civil rights organization was forced to create new bogeymen to keep the game going. They branched out into classifying people in groups as haters, and whipped up anti-hate lists, branding anyone and anything that didn't agree with their extreme left way of thinking a hater, which has had disastrous consequences for many of those targeted. Many news outlets are critical of the SPLC's fundraising, calling the group a fraud that uses hyperbole and overstates the prevalence of hate groups to raise large amounts of money, and reporting that it exaggerated the threat posed by the Klan and similar groups in order to raise money, discriminated against black employees, and used misleading fundraising tactics. That hasn't prevented donations from gullible leftist extremists like actor George Clooney, who, through his Clooney Foundation for Justice, gave the SPLC a $1 million grant in the wake of the white nationalist gathering in Charlottesville in 2017. Many more misinformed and those with a leftist agenda keep the SPLC humming, as it maintains revenue of $136 million and an endowment of $471 million in 2018. Twitter 9 launched in 2006. Twitter, an online news and social networking service, broadcasts short bursts of inconsequential information over the internet, called tweets, something adored by the brain dead masses whose attention spans have been reduced to those of gnats. Used by more than 100 million people, who post over 500 million tweets a day, it is one of the 10 most visited websites in the world. So popular is this service that during the last U.S. presidential election, Twitter was the biggest source of breaking news on election day. Twitter has been in the news lately, mostly for banning users who might be considered politically conservative or right-leaning, while allowing leftist users to do as they wish. The U.S. Congress 10, although ostensibly protected by Amendment I of the Constitution's Bill of Rights, senators and representatives regularly violate Americans' freedom of speech. The most recent example of this can be found in the first bill introduced in the Senate this year. Traditionally, the very first bill introduced by the majority party sends an important message about what their legislative priorities are. Senate Bill 1, Strengthening America's Security in the Middle East Act of 2019, would do a few things, but mainly protect Israel from criticism, at the expense of allowing U.S. citizens to exercise their right to free speech. The ACLU stated that Democratic and Republican senators have decided that one of their first orders of business should be to sneak through a bill that would weaken Americans' First Amendment protections, and sends a message to Americans that they will be penalized if they dare to disagree with their government. Although there have been no fewer than 9 roll call votes, the measure is stalled, thankfully, America facing historic border crisis. Border Patrol says people from 44 nations entering illegally across southern border media censors worst crisis in 10 years. Trump right to declare national emergency. By Mark Anderson. Hidalgo County, Texas, the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, where so far this year 25,000 illegal immigrants have evaded apprehension, isn't just dealing with the criminal elements that ride the wave of caravans of Central Americans illegally crossing into the U.S. The valley is also plagued by a meddlesome local media that engages in stereotyping and melodrama intended to shame the people who could do the most, the U.S. Border Patrol, to halt the border crisis into accepting an almost constant exodus of people trudging through Mexico into the U.S. Valley. Media also downplays or ignores the fact that, in addition to the 25,000 who got away, another 120,000 illegal entrants have already been caught so far in this fiscal year, which began October 1, 2018, according to Rio Grande Valley Sector Deputy Chief Border Patrol Agent Raul Ortiz. If such numbers aren't abated, over 1 million people could cross the southern border into the U.S. by year's end, with detention facilities stretched to the breaking point and Border Patrol, immigration judgeships, and other key positions still understaffed. Many Central American adults and children are being simply given a bus ticket so they can freely wander about the U.S. without even a court hearing in the hopes that they'll return for a hearing later. But most importantly, as Ortiz told the Epoch Times regarding the backgrounds of those flooding into the U.S., we actually don't know who they are. So far, here in South Texas, we've apprehended folks from 44 different countries. These are from the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Yemen, Iraq, Pakistan, Iran, you name it. The alternative newspaper The Epoch Times and other alternative media, including AFP, have long noted that the southern border, especially in Texas, is where people from across the world enter the U.S., usually illegally, but you'd be hard-pressed to find anything other than an occasional blurb buried in the back of Valley newspapers about the fact that this isn't just a Central American invasion. Rather, it has involved people traipsing into America from as many as 75 countries over the last 10 years. This writer, having lived in the Valley for over 13 years, rode with civilian border scouts in 2008, among other border news gathering assignments. This includes monitoring the area's conventional media reports. The implication of nearly every written news report and broadcast in this heavily Hispanic region is that all Hispanics, by definition, must be in automatic solidarity and could only believe in open borders with few, if any, conditions. As if a Hispanic conservative who believes in defending the border is an impossibility. Tell that to the 500 or more ardent Trump supporters who lined the streets of McAllen when the president visited the valley on January 10. These supporters, the majority of whom were Hispanic, with some Hispanic children holding signs that said "Finish the Wall," expressed strong support for much stricter border defense. They easily equaled in number the anti-Trump, anti-wall protesters who turned out that day, some of whom apparently had been busting from more distant locales. Valley media did its best to flush the big Hispanic turnout for President Donald Trump down the memory hole. Then, in late March, it trotted out an allegedly accurate poll, conducted by the local University of Texas RGV campus. The poll, lo and behold, suggests that 3 out of every 4 Valley citizens oppose the border wall, as if border defense policy should be based upon the shifting sands of public opinion. The local Monitor newspaper constantly publishes photos of young children and families, although a number of children are brought in by people only claiming to be their parents, to emotionally sell the notion that the only humane way to deal with what appears to be the worst border breach in about 10 years is simply to maintain a more or less open border. An open border, however, incentivizes the very human traffickers and drug traffickers that prey upon vulnerable migrant children and families, for whom the local media, religious charities, and other organizations, including the Catholic Diocese, profess heartfelt concern. Trump is at a crossroads. He did declare an emergency, vetoed an attempt by Congress to nullify the emergency, and secured $8 billion for the wall by getting already budgeted money from other accounts and not relying solely on congressional outlays. But the question is, now what? Military resources from both state and federal levels are at the border, we're told, but it's not altogether clear what's being done. It's time for AFP readers, not just those in border states, to make lots of phone calls to Congress, Trump, senators, state police, state representatives, and other officials to demand border sanity and defense until a sufficient wall and other longer-term measures can come to fruition. Trump writes about sanctions. The economic sanctions only cause more suffering, by Dr. Ron Paul. In late March, President Donald Trump admitted what the Washington policy establishment of both parties would rather be kept quiet. Asked why he intervened to block a new round of sanctions on North Korea, he told the media that he believes the people of North Korea have suffered enough. They are suffering greatly in North Korea, and I just didn't think additional sanctions at this time were necessary, he said. The foreign policy establishment in Washington, whether they are neocons, humanitarian interventionists, so-called realists, or even progressives, have long embraced sanctions as a way to pressure governments into doing what Washington wants without having to resort to war. During my time in Congress, I saw many of my anti-war colleagues on the left vote for sanctions because they believed sanctions are more humane than war. Neocons and other interventionists endorse sanctions because they know that sooner or later they will lead to war, their preferred foreign policy. With his characteristic bluntness, Trump has exposed this big lie. Sanctions are not a more humane alternative to war. They are just another form of war. In fact, they are perhaps the cruelest form of war, because they do not target the military of an adversary, but rather the innocent civilian population. As Trump said, they make people suffer. Sanctions are meant to make life so miserable for the civilian population that it rises up and overthrows a leader out of favor in Washington. In Iraq in the 1990s, those sanctions cost the lives of 500,000 children, but then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright infamously said she thought the price was worth it. But still, the people didn't rise up and overthrow Saddam even as their lives became more and more miserable. So the neocons had to concoct some lies about WMDs, and Iraq was invaded anyway. An estimated 1 million more people were killed in that war. So much for the humanitarianism of sanctions. Sanctions often target water supplies, sewage treatment, medicine, food supply, and other essentials for civilian life. After the people suffer under the soft war of sanctions, though, they must often are forced to suffer again as the U.S. attacks anyway. That was the case in Iraq, Libya, Syria, and elsewhere, and it may soon be the case for Venezuela and perhaps even North Korea. In Yemen, sanctions have contributed to the death of some 80,000 children from starvation. Millions more are facing starvation, yet they continue to resist Saudi and U.S. demands that they overthrow their government. Sanctions do not inspire people to rise up and overthrow their governments. Most civilians suffering under sanctions couldn't throw out their rulers even if they wanted to. After being impoverished and malnourished for years, are they really expected to take on their own government's military? I am glad to hear Trump tell the truth about sanctions. They hurt the powerless in the false hope that the powerful will change their behavior. No new sanctions on North Korea is a good start. Now how about dismantling the inhumane and counterproductive sanctions from Caracas to Damascus and from Moscow to Beirut? Let's return to a foreign policy of peace and engagement, backed by a strong military for our defense alone. Rift has never been wider between the U.S. and EU. By Richard Walker. As relations between Washington and the European Union, EU, continue to deteriorate, it is conceivable that one of the casualties will be the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. It could be replaced by a new European army led by Germany and France. Britain would not be part of the leadership of such a force, or perhaps might choose not to be involved, given that Brexit will hopefully soon end its links to the EU. While some may say this is speculative, there is sufficient evidence that the NATO alliance is crumbling. Not for the first time, European members of the Transatlantic Alliance have to consider its demise and what will replace it. According to diplomatic sources in Europe who spoke to AFP on condition of anonymity, there have been discussions in the corridors of power in Brussels about crumbling relations with the Trump administration and the urgent need, with Britain leaving the EU, to contemplate a new European military force to replace NATO. Since his election victory, President Donald Trump has consistently reproached Europe for making America pay the financial burden for sustaining NATO. He has suggested he has not been fully committed to NATO's Article 5 that essentially commits every NATO member to defend any member who is attacked. But more importantly, perhaps, is the stark divergence of Washington foreign policy from that of the EU. The latest example was the decision by 22 EU member states to publicly attack Trump for supporting Israel's illegal occupation of the Golan Heights. The president essentially gave Israel a green light to claim ownership of the Golan. The EU also refused to back Trump and Israel's campaign to destroy the international Iran nuclear deal and has taken a harder line with the Saudis over their slaughter of innocents in Yemen. There are some in the NATO fold and in Washington who have feared these past 2 years that deep cracks in the alliance were widening as the EU and the Trump administration pursued different foreign policy goals and fought over funding. A British diplomat based in Brussels told AFP off the record that, in his words, "The writing has been on the wall for some time that NATO will not survive this Trump presidency." He added, "Some of us thought it fanciful when a suggestion came from Washington that NATO should include Israel in its ranks. It wasn't the first time this subject was broached within NATO, but this time it was progressed by pro-Israel hawks close to the Trump White House who thought it might heal rifts, but it was designed to draw NATO into Israel's Middle East strategy. It was dismissed as unworkable. Anyway, it would never have passed muster with Europeans." Interestingly, Israel would be unhappy to see the end of NATO. According to Daniel Shapiro, a former U.S. ambassador to Israel, writing in Haaretz, he has argued that such a move would empower Russia, especially in the Middle East, and that Israelis should encourage Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to prevail upon Trump to stay in the alliance. Meanwhile, in Europe there has been much confused thinking about NATO, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron suggesting the creation of a European quick reaction force to complement the alliance. Trump, however, has angrily dismissed it as insulting. "NATO top brass have been trying to damp down any talk of a European quick response force, or a European army, even though 22 states could put over 1 million soldiers in the field. There are, however, factors outside NATO's control. Aside from serious and ever-growing foreign policy disputes between the EU and Washington, there is always the possibility of a tariff war over cars and other products that would shred relations between Washington and one of the world's biggest economic blocs. Some senators have been putting together legislation aimed at preventing Trump from ending NATO membership without congressional approval, but it remains to be seen if they have majority approval in the Senate. In contrast, the president believes that he has the authority to make such a move. He may be right. All it would require for him to end a formal treaty like the one with NATO is an executive order. After 70 years of NATO, it is difficult to calculate the outcome of its demise. By any measure, it could result in a massive realignment of power that could weaken both Europe and the US militarily. It could mean that any future U.S. conflicts across the globe would be denied European support, and the bases needed to reach many parts of the world. Europe likewise would have to go it alone and deal with its own security. While it is not clear if the American public as a whole would support leaving the alliance, it is no longer a subject that can be pushed under the rug. Brexit deadline passes, but UK still in EU. By Mark Anderson. The long-awaited March 29 deadline for the UK to leave the European Union, EU, has come and gone. Unfortunately, the indecision surrounding the UK's next steps has left the UK well within the EU's clutches after nearly 3 years of negotiations between UK and EU officials about Britain's anticipated exit. Some dedicated British activists, however, are tired of what they describe as deceptive political theatre out of Westminster, designed, they maintain, to ultimately disobey the will of the voters as expressed in the Brexit referendum back in June 2016. Justin Walker, a longtime British Constitution Group member, military veteran, and activist, is well aware that Britain is still embedded in the EU's regulatory network and entangled in the newly created EU-directed European army. Outlining a constructive response to the Brexit folly, Walker told AFP that he's helping to lead the new Chartist movement to promote a far better vision that transcends Brexit and aims for lasting reforms intended to bring people together and tackle specific problems, while exposing the City of London's monetary manipulation and other illicit operations of the power behind the throne. In the wake of the UK House of Commons voting Friday, March 29, against Britain leaving the EU, the third time the legislative body has rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's proposed Brexit deal, Walker called the Brexit debate and the UK government's inability or unwillingness to finalise and implement it all pantomime and divisive deep state manipulation. Walker's outlook reflects the views of the more astute Brits who believe an acceptable exit is simply not in the cards, or that an exit simply won't happen. The original Chartists became a mass movement in 1836, which lasted about 12 years, with the goal of making government more transparent and accountable, but the mid-19th century British state wanted no part of populist-style reforms and even resorted to armed force to quell some Chartist-based protests. Still, when Chartism's original leader, Fergus O'Connor, died, over 40,000 people turned out for his funeral. The new Chartist movement, NCM, honors key Chartist traditions while enlarging the original mission. The core message Walker and his fellow NCM activists want to convey, as Britain's chances of a successful, meaningful exit from the EU look increasingly unlikely, is contained in the NCM Sovereign People's Charter, the Charter's 7 requirements, in a slightly abbreviated form, are as follows: full restoration of our ancient and proven common law, trial by jury and annulment by jury, constitution that puts the people firmly back in authority over our agenda-driven and self-serving politicians, judges, lawyers, and bankers by lawfully removing from them their powers to punish and deceive, the creation of prosperity by bringing back debt-free and interest-free treasury money that's based on the wealth and labor of our nation, exactly as we did in 1914 with the enormously successful Bradbury Pound, the ending of abuse and harm of all children whilst protecting the common law rights of parents to strengthen the family unit, the assurance that we have the armed services needed to fully protect the sovereignty of our country whilst also guaranteeing the operational resources needed for community policing to keep our streets safe, the exposure and removal of the hidden and alien system of legalese governance that controls our judges and court system whilst using outright fraud, deception, and entrapment to unlawfully impoverish and constrain the ordinary people, the call for a new and democratic Europe of sovereign countries to replace the planned European Union superstate, in other words, a fresh European initiative free from the unelected and unaccountable European Commission and the privately run, debt-creating European Central Bank, the guarantee that science is always used for the well-being and advancement of all and not for the profit of the few. This includes the immediate termination of the dangerous 5G rollout, that is, high-intensity, next-generation mass communications infrastructure, along with opposing fracking, geo-engineering and compulsory vaccinations, as the new Chartists forge ahead and circulate their ideas. What Walker wants people on both sides of the Brexit debate to understand is that they've been deceived by a devious mass media and corrupt and negligent politicians, among others, who falsely portrayed most Brexit supporters as potentially violent right-wing racists. Former Trump advisor explains how deep state took him down, by Donald Jeffries, reinvigorated by Robert Mueller's findings that there was no evidence of collusion between the Russians and Donald Trump's campaign. Former foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos is pulling no punches. Papadopoulos epitomized the insignificant nature of Mueller's investigation, as he served 12 days of a 2-week sentence for lying to FBI agents about his contacts with individuals supposedly linked to Russia during the 2016 campaign. After he was charged, Trump and others dismissed Papadopoulos as a low-level volunteer, akin to an office boy. Papadopoulos is now promoting his new book, Deep State Target: How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. Papadopoulos's lawyers have requested a pardon from Trump, and he is considering withdrawing his initial guilty plea. Papadopoulos told Fox and Friends recently that the special counsel's investigation was a hoax. During his book tour, The former Trump aide is being accompanied by a film crew working on a documentary series about him, entitled Papa. The embattled 31-year-old described experiencing a political rebirth to foreign policy. The story went that Maltese professor Joseph Mifsud, who hasn't been seen since November 2017, told Papadopoulos that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton, and the young aide then passed this information on to Australian diplomat Alexander Downer in London. Papadopoulos admitted hearing from Mifsud that the Russians had hacked emails from the Democratic National Committee but denies that he relayed this to Downer. In his new book, Papadopoulos described the Russiagate probe as, at best it's prosecutorial overreach, at worst, it's the deep state declaring war on Donald Trump, and with that, a war on truth, justice, and the American way. Papadopoulos recounted being pressured by the FBI into lying as part of a plea bargain. Papadopoulos's wife Mangiant, a lawyer and aspiring actress, is rumored to be working on her own book about the Russian investigation. Trump himself has called Papadopoulos a liar, but his former aide remains loyal to the president. I wouldn't change a thing, Papadopoulos declared on Hill TV. I think the 2016 election was a historic moment. It was a monumental event in, I think, global history, and it obviously changed modern political history in the United States and certainly around the world. Papadopoulos acknowledged the uncertainty of depending upon Trump clearing his name, saying, "The president has an unorthodox way of handing out pardons. I can't say that I regret it because, like I said in the beginning of this, so much of the information about me was fake. And now that I'm allowed to actually speak for the first time using my own words, and I wrote a book that allows the readers to understand how I got from A to Z, and how the world got from A to Z," Papadopoulos stated. "I can't say that I regret it because, fortunately, it was basically a manufactured investigation that I think my book will act as a roadmap to lead another investigation into those who committed actually treasonous acts into American citizens and the president himself." In the book, Papadopoulos paints a picture of a vast conspiracy against him, involving far more persons than the vanished Mifsud. His scenario introduces an intriguing cast of characters, including a Russian woman who pretended to be Vladimir Putin's niece, an Israeli who offered him $10,000 in cash, an American professor stationed in London whom he suspects was acting as an FBI informant, a series of senior Obama administration officials and, of course, Mueller and his team of prosecutors. Yahoo News predictably remained skeptical in an interview with Papadopoulos, with the reporter scoffing that the Australian government is lying, Downer is lying, the FBI is lying, and Robert Mueller is lying. Papadopoulos calmly replied, "What's so hard to believe about that? Who are these government officials? The ones who are under investigation themselves currently. These are not choir boys." George Papadopoulos had christened himself Patient Zero, indicating he believed he was the initial target in Mueller's laughable investigation. In January, Papadopoulos was hired by the board of advisors at C3 International, a pro-Trump medical marijuana company. "There has been so much misinformation about what my real case was all about. It was about a professor I met in London who the FBI told the world was a Russian agent," Papadopoulos said on Fox and Friends. "Because if I had told anyone in the campaign, it would have been a conspiracy, but it would have been based on Western intelligence basically fabricating the entire thing. As I am talking to Mueller's people and they are trying to get me to say something that I know is not true, I just couldn't." Doubling down on Russian collusion, Democrats can't give up on Russian fairy tale, but real story involves Hillary's meddling. By Donald Jeffries. When the findings of special counsel Robert Mueller were finally announced in late March, those who had been trumpeting collusion fanatically didn't take it very well. Mueller found absolutely no evidence of any collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, and exuberant Donald Trump called it complete and total exoneration. Democrats and anti-Trump celebrities were almost apoplectic in their reactions. Cher tweeted, "I have not, nor will I change my opinion of Trump, his evil, or his ties to Russia. He is up to his neck in crime and corruption." Comedian Chelsea Handler, tasteful as always, tweeted, "I will admit my feelings for Mueller conflicted now and my sexual attraction to him is in peril. But I still believe there is a lot more to come, and we must all march in the streets if we don't see that report. This quickly became the new mantra, with cries of release the full report emanating from every corner of the establishment. Comedian Sarah Silverman, clinging to Russian fantasies like so many others, urged Trump to focus on finding, disabling and punishing those who worked for Russia to attack the U.S. election. While the world's unlikeliest conspiracy theory retreated into the background, another possible foreign connection to the 2016 presidential election emerged. Ukraine's top prosecutor, General Yuri Lutsenko, told Hill TV last week that he has begun investigating whether his country's law enforcement apparatus purposefully leaked financial records about recently convicted former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort during the 2016 campaign. In an effort to assist Hillary Clinton, Lutsenko was prompted by the release of a tape recording that allegedly revealed a top law enforcement official admitting his agency had leaked the records in order to help Clinton's campaign. This leaking of what was dubbed the Black Ledger resulted in Manafort's resignation from Trump's campaign and became a key allegation in the Russian collusion probe that went on for over 2 years. The Ukrainian parliamentarian who released the recording secured a court ruling that the leak constituted an illegal intrusion into the American election campaign. Lutsenko told The Hill, "Today we will launch a criminal investigation about this and we will give legal assessment of this information." Many believe that the infamous Russian dossier obtained by retired British spy Christopher Steele began when he discussed securing evidence against Manafort with top Justice Department officials. Lutsenko also told The Hill that the Obama U.S. Embassy had interfered in his efforts to prosecute corruption cases in 2016. He stated that the U.S. ambassador had given him a list of defendants that he would not be allowed to pursue and also refused to cooperate in an investigation into whether U.S. aid had been misappropriated in Ukraine. The State Department quickly issued a statement that it no longer financially supports Lutsenko's office in its anti-corruption mission and called his allegation about the do not prosecute list an outright fabrication. Rep. Pete Sessions seemed to corroborate Lutsenko, writing in a private letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that he should recall the current U.S. ambassador, claiming that she'd made disparaging comments about Trump. Mueller's findings of no collusion make even more laughable all the endless reports by the mainstream media that such connections were real and treasonous. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough claimed the media had nothing to apologize for, and declared, "What would you have had the media do over the past 2 years when Donald Trump lied throughout the 2016 campaign about his contacts with Russia?" Rep. Adam Schiff, DeKalb, one of Trump's most vocal critics in Congress, steadfastly clung to the narrative and ignored Republican demands for his resignation. Trump himself told Fox News, "Schiff should be forced out of office. He is a disgrace to our country." While Democrats clamored for the release of the full Mueller report in desperate hopes of some hidden impeachable offense, Trump announced his intention to release classified FBI documents used to launch the investigation into Russian election interference. Attorney General William Barr told Congress, "The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities." When the report is eventually released, it is bound to have the prerequisite redactions, which will in turn bolster theories that media evidence is being covered up. Barr, one of Trump's countless veteran deep state appointees, clung to the fanciful notion that Russia did interfere, just not in cahoots with the Trump campaign. WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Kristen Hrafnsson summed things up nicely, telling RT, "I have no idea how the mainstream media, who were most active in this Russiagate frenzy, will recover. I simply don't see that happening. In a normal world, a lot of journalists would be emptying their desks today. Why must the West beg for forgiveness?" By Patrick J. Buchanan. As the Democratic Party quarrels over reparations for slavery, a new and related issue has arisen, raised by the presidents of Mexico. Andrés Manuel López Obrador has written Pope Francis and King Felipe VI to demand their apologies for the Spanish conquest of Mexico that began 500 years ago with the invasion of Hernando Cortés. Arriving on the Gulf Coast in 1519, Cortés marched in 2 years to what is today's Mexico City to impose Spanish rule. the Spanish language and culture, and the Catholic faith upon the indigenous peoples. One culture, one civilization was imposed upon another, wrote President López Obrador. There were massacres and oppression. The so-called conquest was waged with the sword and the cross. They built their churches on top of the temples. He demanded that the king and the pope ask for forgiveness for the abuses inflicted on the indigenous peoples of Mexico. Now, no one denies that great sins and crimes were committed in that conquest, but are not the Mexican people, 130 million of them, far better off because the Spanish came and overthrew the Aztec Empire? Did not 300 years of Spanish rule and replacement of Mexico's pagan cults with the Catholic faith lead to enormous advances for its civilization and human rights? Or is there never a justification for one nation to invade another, conquer its people, impose its rule, and uproot and replace its culture and civilization? Is cultural genocide always a crime against humanity, even if the uprooted culture countenanced human sacrifice? Did the Aztecs have a right to be left alone by the European world? If so, whence came that right? Which leads to another question: are all civilizations and cultures equal, or are some more equal than others? Are some superior? Before recent decades, most Americans were taught to believe the West stood above all other civilizations, and America was its supreme manifestation, and much of the world seemed to agree. As for the assertion that all civilizations and cultures are equal, that is an ideological statement. But where is the historic, scientific or empirical evidence to support that proposition? How many people really believe that? Spain's foreign minister Josep Borrell said it was weird to receive now this request for an apology for events that occurred 500 years ago. He wondered if Spain should seek an apology from France for the invasion of the Iberian Peninsula and crimes committed by the armies of Napoleon, or if France could demand an apology from Italy for the invasion of Gaul by Julius Caesar. Unlikely to get an apology from the king, López Obrador made a better with Pope Francis, who is into begging for forgiveness for crimes committed in the Spanish-Portuguese conquest and rule of South America. In Bolivia in 2015, the Pope declared, "I say this to you with regret. Many grave sins were committed against the native people of America in the name of God. I humbly ask forgiveness, not only for the offense of the Church herself, but also for crimes committed against the native people during the so-called conquest of America." As the New York Times related in its story on the Chile response in Madrid to Mexico's demand, other Western leaders, not only Barack Obama, are very much into this apology fad. Justin Trudeau has apologized for Canada's mistreatment of its indigenous peoples. France's Emmanuel Macron has apologized for the torture of rebels in Algeria's war for independence. The Spanish right, however, is not with the program. Alberto Rivero, leader of the Ciudadanos, called López Obrador's demand an intolerable offense to the Spanish people. Rafael Hernando of the Popular Party dismissed it with contempt. "We Spaniards went there, to Mexico, and ended the power of tribes that assassinated their neighbors with cruelty and fury." Behind this demand for an apology from Spain and the Church's view of history familiar to Americans, and rooted in clashing concepts about who we are, and were, have the Western peoples who conquered and changed much of the world been, on balance, a blessing to mankind or a curse? Is the history of the West, though replete with the failings of all civilizations, not unique in the greatness of what it produced, or the West's crimes of imperialism, colonialism, genocide, racism, slavery, and maltreatment of minorities of color so sweeping, hateful, and shameful they cancel out the good done? Is the white race, as Susan Sontag wrote, the cancer of human history? As we see the monuments and memorials to the great men of our past desecrated and dragged down, the verdict among a slice of our intellectual and cultural elites is already in. Thumbs down. They agree with the moral shakedown artist of Mexico City. Query: can peoples who are ashamed of their nation's past do great things in its future, or is a deep-seated national guilt, such as that which afflicts many Germans today, a permanent incapacitating feature of a nation's existence?